Good afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer emeritus from York College, City University of New York. Welcoming you to this November 9th edition, post-election celebratory edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM. That's WBAI on the Pacifica Network. And we're broadcasting in collaboration with ycradio.org. That's the York College online radio station as well. Well, let's get right to it. We're running a little bit behind schedule. Controlling the virus. I continue to open every show talking about that. We need to control this virus, and we need to do it together. That's been the theme of the various hosts on WBAI across the dial, urging us to do that. And we certainly want to chime in accordingly. Let's control this virus. It's dangerous. It's spiraling out of control. But we in New York have done a reasonably good job. Let's stay the course and hope that under this new administration, there will be some emphasis on science instead of madness. Speaking of madness, this is numbing, having to stay at home and limit your work and this and that. I know people are getting tired, but nonetheless, we cannot get tired. Can't be no ways tired now. We've got to hang in there. But if you are having anxiety, if you're just a little bit upset, or there are issues going on in your household or with family or neighbors, we have established by we, the Institute of the Black World 21st Century Black Family Summit, a listening line, a community cares. I like that. Community. Yes, community cares listening line, where you can dial in and there will be a volunteer on the other side to listen, a culturally appropriate listener to what you have to say. And where you need counseling or various services, those referrals will be made. This is a partnership that is being promoted also with WBAI, and I understand we are getting response. The number to call, take it down, 877-827-6677. That's 877-827-6677. That is the IBW, Black Family Summers Community Cares listening line. Now, in case you missed it, it was certainly broadcast live here on WBAI and with WPFW for that matter, on this past Thursday, 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock p.m., a powerful town hall meeting on the impact of the presidential election on Black America and the Pan-African world. It featured Black America's brightest and best, carried right here live on WBAI. But if you missed it, you can go to the IBW website, ibw21.org. That's ibw21.org, to the website. And you can do it. And people, I mean, we're getting tremendous feedback, tremendous hits on the website in relationship to this very powerful town hall meeting. Also, I'd like to say that that's one of the reasons why WBAI buddies are promoted, at least I do, here on the station, because of these kinds of powerful partnerships that WBAI not only forges with organizations like the Institute of the Black World 21st Century around these kinds of events, but also other organizations. But we really need to be in a posture of sustainability based on predictability of income, and that's what WBAI buddies do. So I continue to urge you to, if you can afford to, and there are those who can, to become a WBAI buddy. You do that if you can afford to by simply pledging a minimum of $10 a month. And if you can do more than that, do more than that. I am a WBAI buddy and I do more than that because I can afford to do more than that. And it can be kind of, it can come out of your credit card, your debit card, checking account, savings account. You can make the arrangements for how it is to be done. You can go to give2wbai.org, give to WBAI, and that's the numeral to WBAI.org, and sign up to become a WBAI buddy. It would be great if we could just five WBAI buddies today. And I say that against the backdrop of really, really being very, very delighted to have been able to have the Institute of the Black World 21st Century have this powerful town hall meeting broadcast live on WBAI. Finally, at the end of the show, we're going to go up on the soapbox again, but it will be you on the soapbox. One simple question. What does the 2020 presidential election mean to you? You can interpret that in any way you want to. That's the question we'll be dealing with. What does the 2020 presidential election mean to you? And of course, I'm going to give you the number in advance, 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. Once we finish our interview with our dream team, we'll be on the case in relationship to talking about the, you're getting your opinions on the election. I am joined now by my dream team, and I love these two brilliant analysts because they can help shape and understand what is going on. And that is none other than Earl Afari Hutchinson, who is the editor and publisher of the Hutchinson Report, has a radio, wildly popular radio show on our sister station in Los Angeles. And of course, Bill Fletcher, veteran social and political activist, labor activist, and also had a show for many years on WPFW, a sister station in Washington, D.C. Earl Afari Hutchinson and Bill Fletcher, welcome both to Vantage Point.
Always a pleasure. How you doing, Bill?
Hey, man, good.
All right, well, let's dive right into it. I'm just going to ask you to briefly get your initial sort of takeaways from the election. Let's start with you, Earl. I know you've been writing a great deal about it and whatever, and I have some more in-depth questions, but just your initial, quickie on takeaway from the recent election.
Well, three things. One, going back a little bit, I did pick or handicap. I handicapped the Biden win some weeks ago, and actually months ago, if all the stars aligned, and I figured they would one way or another. I hadn't anticipated COVID, which aligned it even better. But nonetheless, I had it about 51, 52 Biden in the popular vote, Trump 48, 49 in the popular vote, and close to 300 in the Electoral College for Biden. Why? Simply because, when COVID came in, that sealed the deal. I was a little concerned about the economy, how Trump might spend that. And we well know that no sitting president with the appearance of a humming economy, a good economy, I said appearance, they don't lose. So that was the only thing I was concerned about. When COVID came in, that pretty much knocked it out. Secondly, make no mistake, it was a victory and is a victory for centrist Democrats. And to an extent, a less extent, progressives, more on that later. But the flip side of that, Trump got 72 million votes. Now, it's not just the monster number of votes he got, but where those votes came from. We're not just talking about his base, the usual kind of stereotypical, snuff-dipping, cowboy hat-wearing, card-carrying KKK, Klan type, the wing nuts. Trump expanded his base, his traditional base, by over 10 million votes. And we're talking about digging deep into the heartland, the South, and pretty much most of the country. A broad cross-section of Americans bought into this guy for a variety of reasons. So that's something going forward that is going to be very challenging. The third thing.
That's like five already.
Here's the last one. And basically Biden. Biden's got three major challenges. You still got.
Well, let's get into the challenges later. That's one of my questions. Okay, so let's just leave those to the table. Bill, your initial kind of takeaway from the election.
Well, I have several. So one is, I think it's very important that we're cautious about how quickly we come to judgment about all aspects of this election, because it was held under circumstances that was simply unprecedented, at least in our lifetime. We've never had a national election where there's been a plague and where that completely derailed the ground strategy of the Democrats. It didn't derail the Republicans in the same way, because they basically didn't believe the plague existed. So I think that that's one of the things that has to be factored in. The second thing is that because of the massive turnout and the huge number of early voting voters, you know, the mail-ins and other things, I'm very suspicious of the exit polls. And I'm not really, like, for example, this whole notion of Trump gaining black voters, very suspicious of it in any significant numbers. That said, I think in terms of the absolute numbers, as Earl was saying, it's really quite phenomenal. But one other thing is that there's a lot of liberals talking about how divided the country is. And I just happened to go back to look at the 1960 election results. And on the popular vote, Kennedy beat Nixon by, I believe, under 1%. So one of the things that we've got to deal with is that Biden won. And I repeat, he won. And whether it was one vote or 1,000 votes or whatever, he won. And that there's a way that I'm starting to sense that people, that many people out there are like second guessing it. Well, maybe it wasn't a good enough victory or whatever. This country has been divided from its very inception. Most of the elections are fairly close. So I think that we have to be very, very careful as we're going forward. The last thing I want to say, Ron, is that this was a race where race, revanchism, and the rejection of reality came together to fuse the Trump coalition. And I mean, there's obviously other factors, but this issue of race and revanchism, this anger, the many of these votes, apparently the new votes that came forward, in fact, allegedly were Republicans who got motivated, who had sat out 2016. And then this rejection of reality. This is probably the hardest thing to get our hands around, that millions of people are prepared to reject the reality of COVID.
Mm.
I'll stop there.
Yeah, two things I just want to from both of your comments. One, that I think need to be amplified. And that is, Trump was willing to risk his staff, the people who came to his rallies. He was willing to let them die because of the denial of the science. You know, I mean, it came out of these spreader events. And the data is showing that from those spreader events, I mean, literally thousands, hundreds of people have gotten infected and people have died from this reckless behavior. There was no ethical considerations here. And that, to some extent, you know, may have constrained the Democrats. And the other is this polling. And many, many people are questioning the polling data. And then finally, the expansion issue is one that I would want to talk about, because I was one of the ones who said the only way that Trump could win this election, because I've always said the biggest political party is not the Democrats, it's not the Republicans, it's non-voters. And so when Trump went back to the same places, what he really was doing was pulling out more of the same kind of people who sat out the election last time but believed in what he had to do, I think. I mean, that's my view of it. So I don't think he really, like, got more independents. I mean, we'll see what the data says, or more, you know, traditional Republicans and so forth. I think he went right back to that same base and pulled out more. And the same possibilities are there for African-Americans and other constituencies as well. Let me quickly move to the next question, which is baffling. And what happened to the blue wave? I mean, I was one of the ones who thought that, wow, you know, it's going to be, given how terrible this man is, you know, there's going to be, the Republicans are going to pay a price for being complicit down the line. Susan Collins didn't pay a price. A whole bunch of people didn't pay a price. No, I understand that no house really flipped at the state level. And so in a way, it was like a split verdict. And now the Senate is in play. There was a thought that the Senate would be in the hands of the Democrats, but it hangs in the balance in not a very good way in terms of what the outcome of Georgia. So, Earl, what happened?
Well, you already said it, and Bill said it too. From the beginning, we've had a deeply polarized country. It's not new. And so all you did was see that now. In fact, actually, you saw it in spades. So if you've got a deeply polarized, divisive country, almost split right down the middle, why would you think there would be a wave one way or the other? I mean, that's just been the recent and not so recent political history of this country. You know, the other thing, we talk about the blue wave. I think we have to be careful about that. You know, it's always frightening, you know, Ron and Bill, when I look at the electoral map of America, year in, year out, election in, election out, and especially the last couple of elections, we see your coast, Bill, where you are, Ron, where you are, the East Coast, where I am on the West Coast, that narrow strip from Washington down to the Mexican border, and, of course, going up to Vermont, the strip, and then, of course, going south to Virginia. Basically, you see blue. And then when you look at the much of the rest of the country, with exception of pockets like Illinois and Minnesota, you see the sea of red. I mean, it's just really extraordinary to see that somebody just stepping in from somewhere else would think, wait a minute, you know, this is a red country. Well, the fact of the matter is, much of the country is. So I just think the polarization, Ron and Bill, I think it was reflective of why there was no blue wave, nor really, when you really think about it, except in a few places, was there really a red wave. There's one other thing. Collins and the rest of them, these are incumbents. It's tough under any circumstances, wave or no wave, to knock out a Senate incumbent. Almost impossible.
I guess I would say, though, that it's, if we want to talk about a major wave, yeah. But I was thinking, and when you looked at the reaction to Obama, for example, in 2012, there was somewhat of a wave. I mean, the Republicans came back in a vengeance, right? And they captured more seats in the Senate. They captured more seats in the House. 2016 was a kind of resurgence on the Democratic side because, you know, the House was retaken. So that's what I'm sort of referring to. Yeah, the presidency, yes, and the popular vote, yes. But there was an anticipation, not of like some tsunami, but that there would be enough, that there would be a slight expansion perhaps in the House, and that the Senate would be possible. Bill, I mean, Bill, your reaction to the absence of the blue wave.
I've been thinking about this on that. I think that there's several layers on this. One is that the Democrats pinned a lot on the notion of an anti-Trump united front. Mm-hmm. And that the unity would be opposition to the insanity of this administration, and that would be enough to bring forth this wave. And I think that what it appears, at least events have said, is that that actually wasn't enough. That that was important. It was important in terms of the Biden vote, but it didn't translate down ballot. And that's the thing, because it appears, at least, and Earl, I don't know, I'm sure you studied this, it appears that there were places where there was all kinds of crossover voting of people that were voting for Trump, for Biden, and then voting for a down-ballot Republican. And so part of what that says to me is that the campaign message, or the down-ballot campaign, really was insufficient, that the mobilization, the Republican mobilizations you were talking about, Ron, against Obama, were not simply getting rid of Obama. They had a very definite vision of they wanted to put in its place. And I feel that these down-ballot Democrats, in many cases, either were, you know, kind of doing a little bit of a dance, or were just sort of understating the case and believing that the antipathy towards Trump would be enough.
Let me just chime in on that piece there, because I happen to believe that that was a part of the case. I think that not only was it the anti-Trump thing, I think while COVID was clearly a decisive factor, and in fact, I wonder if it had not been for COVID, one wonders whether or not Trump might have actually won. This is just my own. But I think that what was lacking even at the top was get Trump out, yes, soul of America, yes, COVID, yes, but a more clearly articulated vision of what this really means, and particularly in terms of economics. I think that some of that may have been missing. I think they really, at the top, played it safe not to lose, as opposed to, in some ways, in basketball terms, as we say it, or even in athletic terms, you know, to win. But that's just my own kind of take. Now, I want to come to a very, and Earl, you have a piece out on this, and that's the strategy question. In terms of the mobilization of bases. And we had this conversation before, the whole effort to bring back white working class voters in Pennsylvania, throughout the Wisconsin, and really across the country, versus doubling down on bringing in more black voters, more brown voters, a much more sustained effort to pull out the literally, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of non-voters. Earl, you come out straightforward and say the notion that black voters were responsible for Biden's victory is erroneous. You say it was really Biden being able to cut into those white working class voters. Talk to us about it.
Well, actually, I didn't say erroneous. What I did say was that we just have to maybe tweak the narrative a little bit based on the data. Mm-hmm. So when I looked at it a little bit closer, I mean, the consensus is black voters gave Biden the White House. Well, to an extent, we can always make that case, only because, as we well know, in any season, the overwhelming majority of votes and voters are going, black voters are going to be Democratic, 85 to 90%. I mean, that's been unchangeable for decade after decade. So, I mean, Biden's going to get that vote anyway. But the nuance is what I looked at. The first one is, I think Trump actually did, forget the exit polls, I think he actually did bump up his percentage of black voters and the black vote. How much, how big, I don't know, but I think there was an increase there. The other thing is, and this is what I argued about Biden, I didn't think that any other Democrat, and I haven't changed, could have beaten Trump, no matter what. I thought Biden was the only one that stood a chance. Why? Because of the question you just asked, Ron, I thought that basically Biden, given his working class roots, given his kind of heartland where he comes from, Delaware and Pennsylvania, that background, and I thought the fact that at the end of the day, he's one of them, them being at least identifiable by working class, white, that he would have a fighting chance better than anybody else at this stage of history. So, again, blending the two. I think we need a populist message, a progressive message, because that's what I am. But I also think it has to be a pragmatic delivery of that message in terms of maintaining our base among black and Hispanics and expanding that. And, of course, reaching out to that segment, as Biden did, peeled off a small segment of Trump's base, i.e. less educated, white working class, blue collar, and rural. He was able to do that to a limited extent in those swing states. It made a difference.
Mm. Okay. All right. Bill, your response, yeah. Your reaction.
Well, just a couple of things, because in general, I agree with what you're saying. Oh, where I would, this may be semantics. I think we have to be careful about how we're referring to Trump and the white worker, because what really seems to come through is that Trump won in 2016, probably, and this time, in all categories. But it's not like it was the white worker that put him over or was substantially his base. The stronger, the higher the income, stronger support for Trump. So that's just one thing. The thing that I really appreciate in what you were raising, Earl, is that in those swing states, Biden was able to flip it back. And what I think is worth looking at is actually whether it was people he flipped back or whether he simply flipped the vote back. In other words, when you look at Wisconsin, just as an example, and think about the problems that had happened in Wisconsin in 2016, the poor strategy on the part of Hillary, the demobilization of voters. Did what we see happen in Wisconsin this time represent the remobilization, or did he actually flip back people who had gone with Trump?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's going to be a lot of debate about that. I know, Earl, in your piece, you suggest that actually this election, Biden underperformed with black voters, and he overperformed. I guess you're saying the same thing, except that, you know, I'm going to see the end of, I'm going to really see what the data looks like. I think that at the end of the day, we're going to show a significant uptick in black voter turnout over 2012. But less than the Obama numbers in 2008, though some people are saying it even cracked that high, because there are just literally, and I guess one of the things I have been talking about is this trade-off in terms of your messaging, you know, because there's kind of this concern that if you come too black, that somehow or another you're going to chase off whites. And so the question is, you know, if black voters are the backbone of your coalition and rescued Biden in South Carolina, and as he conceded on his victory speech, you know, we had his back, metaphorically speaking. He said he'll have ours. But we kind of heard that before, and people are kind of like saying, yeah, but what does that really, really mean at the end of the day? Which brings me to my final question. And that is a little concern I have about, you know, there's a little euphoria. I have not, maybe I missed it. I know when Obama was elected in Chicago and maybe a few cities, there were people out, and particularly in Chicago, huge numbers of people. But the spontaneous eruption all across the country. And as I looked at those crowds in city after city after city, I saw a lot of young people. Multiracial, lots of young people who engaged this time. And there does seem to be some indication that the younger voters was up. And then I got very emotional because I was fearful about whether they're going to end up being disillusioned, because with a Republican president and a Democratic president and a Republican Senate with McConnell in there, I mean, how much is really going to be able to get done, you know, in terms of a progressive agenda? Earl?
Well, Ron, you were doing fine until you added that last part, progressive agenda. I thought you were going to stop at how much is going to get done, period. You know, with McConnell controlling the Senate, if he controls the Senate, very little. It will be an attempt on McConnell's part and the GOP in the Senate to do an Obama II. What's the Obama II? His second term, obstruct, dither, dodge, deny, but basically obstruct all the way up into a Supreme Court justice, which was denied Obama. So I think he would see that template used again, or at least an effort to do that. The saving grace, though, two things. One, can Biden actually, being one of them, i.e. Senator Biden, good old boy Biden, coming out of the Senate, knows all of them, has worked with them, can he change the narrative and get some things done? Some things, for example, a stimulus package that would help all of us, especially working class and small business owners. I think that's a priority. And, Ron, you know, you mentioned COVID. Dealing with that frontally, can we get that done? But that's a minimal requirement. A progressive agenda, number two, it depends, possibly. But here, forget Biden, can progressives, particularly in the House, and also Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, if they stay in the Senate, and a couple of other senators, how can they leverage and how can progressives ensure that we keep pushing and pushing and pushing Biden and progressives that are in these positions to essentially articulate and push for our agenda? If we don't do that and leave it to them, it's not going to happen.
Bill.
Oh, I agree with Earl once again, but I would say that I've thought a lot about what Obama didn't do as president. And one of the things he didn't do, he was not good for building the Democratic Party. And true. I think that one of the things that Biden could do, particularly if he's being sandbagged by the Republicans, is build the party, build the momentum, which means that he has to be almost in continuous campaign mode, much the way that Trump has been.
Amen.
For years, right? And that he really needs to be pushing these issues. I think particularly the Green New Deal. I think the issue of jobs and the environment, as well as certain key foreign policy matters, he really has got to be pushing. Now, immediately, he can do various kinds of executive orders, and it sounds like he's going to do that, and I think that that's great. I think that for progressives, audacity needs to be the word. He cannot repeat what we saw in the Obama-Biden years of trying to be the adult in the room. There's no, this is a different moment. That period in history is gone, if it ever existed. And that we've got to be moved based on audacity.
Well, I really agree with this campaign mode, because I think, and I really agree with the idea, and I was reading something in the paper today, that Obama, having built this incredible machinery, then sort of put it to bed, which I thought was a terrible mistake. What the Republicans have done is carefully build their base, at least, and even the sort of traditional side, because they definitely wanted to get the control of the judiciary. I mean, that's a part of what they have wanted to do over time, one of their major objectives, and they have achieved that for all intents and purposes. So it seems to me that there's a way in which you can feed the base, and I think it's campaign mode. I think you have to go out into the country. And by the way, in so doing, if you're articulating the message, particularly including economics in it, and, you know, I'm going back to the old basic Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson economic common ground, the way he articulated that. I mean, you got to, that's the way to aim at some of these Trump folks who are disaffected. They're calling about grievances and so forth. Well, one of those grievances, I guess, is the economy. And I think there's some legitimacy to the way in which both parties have really not looked at how to more effectively deal with shifts in the economy. I think in that regard, you know, that's a way to begin to build. Because otherwise, if there's the perception that, which is what McConnell will and then will likely want to do, is simply say, all right, you elected these people, you elected the president, what happened? Nothing happened, put us back in. You know, and then there are some ways in which people, if not educated properly about this, may actually fall for that okey-doke. Anyway, my dream team, Earl Afari Hutchinson and Bill Fletcher, thank you so much for, we could go on and on. We could do a whole show on this, you know, because there's so much to unpack, and there's going to be a lot more coming down the road as we sort of look at and analyze in the days ahead. So thank you so much for always be willing to come on here on Vantage Point, to both you, Earl, and to Bill Fletcher. Thank you so much.
Thanks again. Take care, Bill and Ron. Bye now.
Take care. Later.
All right. Well, that's our introductory conversation. We're going to turn to our listening audience now, as we said we would, with that, you know, beginning conversation. A lot to be talked about. But what do you think? What does the 2020 presidential election mean to you? It is actually still unfolding before our very eyes. But what do you think? 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. We have a chance to get a few questioners in, actually quite a few if people are relatively succinct. 212-209-2877. I just have one basic question. What does the 2020 presidential election mean to you? You can give some analysis. As Bill and them have done, we've just tried to do some dissecting. You may have some moments of pride. You may have some anxieties. You may have some feelings of disillusionment. Whatever it is, share that with our WBAI audience now by calling 212-209-2877. In the meantime, while we're waiting, I also just want to reemphasize WBAI buddies. WBAI buddies. Let's be able to sustain WBAI and build and expand WBAI as what I call a citadel of resistance and transformation. I got to believe that there were some in the audience who were out there, you know, saying, at least we got rid of this guy. You know, people may not be happy about some of the other outcomes or what may be in the future, but I think there was a collective for many folks saying, hallelujah. I know it was in the Black community. Black people were holding watch services and everything else, saying, hey, let's get this guy the hell out of here. Anyway, 212-209-2877. Yes, let's go to our listening audience. Good evening, or afternoon, I'm sorry. You are on Vantage Point.
Hello.
How are you?
Hey, Dr. Day, how are you? My name is Erebos. I'm from West Harlem.
Yes.
I think the last thing you said is the key, right? Because if you look at Florida and Texas, they have propositions they voted on. They voted for a $15 minimum wage in Florida. They voted in support of health care for all. And I think one, if not both of the states, supported legalization of medical marijuana. Right.
Yes.
So, and these are typical reactionary states. And at the same time, they voted for these populist issues. They totally repudiated and rejected the virtue signaling, the identity politics, a lot of things that the Democrats were coming down there talking about. And what the last thing you said is actually the key. If you're not offering people something of material substance, they're not going to vote for you. Right. When people sit at the kitchen table, they want to know the price of bread and butter, meat and potatoes. They want to keep their lights on, keep their children healthy, themselves healthy. The rest of that stuff, they don't want to hear about it. That's good for where we live. Like, I'm in New York, so that's good for the you know, so-called, you know, progressives and neoliberals and, you know, the coastal communities, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, Democrats. That's good for people out here. But when you start getting into the Rust Belt, Sunshine Belt, you know, industrial Midwest, you know, which really doesn't exist anymore, that's the people care about economic issues of substance, not the rest of that stuff. And if it wasn't for this coronavirus, and one of your hosts, one of your brothers there said it, you know, or it might have been you. I think, yeah, it was you who said it. If it wasn't for the coronavirus, I think Biden would have got wiped out.
I'm looking back and I'm saying if Trump was his worst, the orange man was his worst enemy, because if he could have just focused, particularly after he got the virus and came out and said, as Christie did, I made a mistake. Let's get serious about this. And I think this is scary. I mean, the division that we see in this country, but millions and millions of people voting for him in spite of his ugly behavior, the white nationalism, the misogyny, the chauvin. I mean, in spite of all of that, people were willing to vote for him. It's quite scary. I got to move on, my friend. Appreciate your call so much and your analysis. Let's go to our next caller. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah. How do I feel about this election? Well, you know, we have 70 million people who are voting for a crazy person. But you know what? That even crazy people say things that are profound too. You know, I mean, he touched the nerve with people. I think a lot of those 70 million, they feel. How do I put it? They feel that there's a double standard in this country against whites, and I think there's a grain of truth in that too, and I think that's where he gets his support, and everything else. Everything else just goes along with it. I mean, if you could hook somebody into one idea, you know, and everything else would go along with it. So his craziness, you know, I know a lot of Trump supporters, and they don't support a lot of things he said. Okay, but they do support certain things that they stick with him about, and I think that double standard has a lot to do with that. I'm a progressive. I voted for Biden. I don't have too much faith in the Democratic Party. I'm a Bernie Sanders man. I think identity politics ruined his campaign. And I think we have a lot of work to do. And we need to have open conversations, you know.
Right. Okay, well, let's do that. Appreciate your call. The question before our audience is, what does the 2020 presidential election mean to you, in whatever way you choose to comment on it? 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. And don't forget, I was about to finish my message on becoming a WBAI buddy. You can do that by going to give2wbai.org. Give2wbai.org. A minimum of $10 per month, $120 a year, checking account, savings account, credit card, debit card, all of those are available so that we can sustain and build this great station. 212-209-2877. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. And Dr. Daniels, appreciate your show. I just wanted to say, you know, I think it should be acknowledged that the election wasn't solely about Biden versus Trump. You know, I think too much credit is given to Trump as far as votes. You know, I believe folks voted party more necessarily than to Trump. You know, secondly, I think, you know, very little talk has been said, you know, and I guess you guys don't control the media, major media, but little credence was given to voters that were purged from the voter rolls in Georgia. I don't know if you want to speak about that.
Speak up just a little louder, would you please?
I was just mentioning that I hadn't seen much said about voters being purged from the voter rolls in Georgia.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right. I'm on, yeah, oh, my God. I mean, Stacey Abrams would have been, would have won her race. They purged, what was it, 100,000 or more initially? Oh, I guess, oh, okay, I was hoping to finish him, have him finish his comments. But yeah, there's a lot of other elements to be included in the conversation. 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point. Good afternoon.
All right, we'll go to the next call.
Okay. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Okay, let's try again.
All right, folks, y'all, you got to be ready when we call on you. 212-209-2877. The question is, what does the 2020 presidential election mean to you in whatever way it means to you? This is kind of an open forum to hear people's, you know, we've been going through a lot, watching TV, at least some of us, and, you know, with anxiety, exhilaration, all kind of emotions that have been going through. This has been an unusual election.
Hello?
As Bill Fletcher said, we've never had an election under these circumstances. Go right ahead. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello, yes. What the election means to me at this time is that we have to, and it's a good example of why we need to study the past and listen to our previous leaders and also note their action. The, euphoria that was exhibited because Biden won was the same on a number of elections in the past. If we remember that Gore stood his ground, as Trump is doing with this stand, perhaps this country would be entirely in a different state. So what I'm saying, the minds that have lived history, Dr. and I have to say, Dr. Claude Anderson, who served under, I think it was Jimmy Carter,
yes,
who appointed three federal judges to the court. We need, to, and who has, and I've mentioned it in the past, books of analytical works showing why it is not just necessary to go out and vote for the top person, but to concentrate on the people within your community, within your states. As it stands now, Biden is, yes, he will be president or has been elected president. But what change will he make? Will the young lady.
Kamala Harris.
Not the vice, but I'm speaking of those brothers and sisters who were shot, who were killed.
Brianna.
The children who were killed. How many more will have to die while we sit down and say, oh, maybe we should have done this or we should have looked at that in a more critical point of view. It is
well, I think that there were, but you know, I think there were many, many people who did have that on their mind. I think there are people who really responded to the protests in the street. There are actually pieces of legislation at the local level and in the national level. There are bills before the Congress of the United States that would not have been there with the provisions they have in them had it not been for the mass movement in the street, particularly led by young people. in that regard. So I really do have to move on to other callers, but I just wanted to say that we do have to do more in that regard, but I do think that we are making some progress, and we do need to continue, as you said, to have the kind of civic education that people know about how to engage this process, not just voting, but engaging at all kinds of levels that we currently don't do. Let's go to our next caller. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello.
Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hello. Okay. My name is Rich. I'm calling from Harlem, kind of an unusual Harlem caller. I'm a white guy. I've lived here in Harlem for 30 years, two-time Obama voter. And I don't think the celebration in the street is about Joe. It's about the fact that we avoided deep dives into fascism. And I just want to say, some people of color in this country that saved us. Thanks. Bye.
I'm having difficulty hearing you. I think you're saying that much of the celebration was about the fact that we avoided fascism. We avoided, the whole question of the madness as a principal proposition. I remember on the town hall meeting, Mayor Roz J. Baraka talked about that. He said, no matter whatever you feel about Biden or whatever, you know, he said, quote unquote, we got to get rid of this guy. Meaning, and by that, he was saying it in street vernacular because he was talking about just how abhorrent, not only in terms of personality, but what he represents and the fact that he could call out people. And people would go storming up upside buses and go armed into places. That is scary. So I appreciate your call. Let's go to our next caller. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Good afternoon. Greg from North Jersey. Thank you for your program. Two things. I am kind of an amateur historian, always interested in stuff. And I lived in Germany for a couple of years of my job back in the 80s. And I always wondered, how did this ever happen, what happened in the 30s? I mean, how could this ever happen? An educated, you know, sophisticated society. What we've seen in the last couple of years with the Trump supporters, the tens of millions of them, I don't blame the Germans so much anymore. It's happening right here, right before our eyes. These people are crazy. They're all part of this, you know, world that they hear these things and they believe absurdities. That's happening. These are our neighbors. These aren't people, right, you know, 70, 80 years ago in Germany. The other thing is about weather, if you will. The whole Midwest, where there's no more jobs, all the factories are closed, things are desperate. I lived in Pennsylvania for about 2.5 years, years ago. The Luzerne County, Wilkes-Barre, Scranton area, the biggest election landslides in history were in 1936 for Franklin Roosevelt. The second highest totals in history were 2008 for Barack Obama. That broke almost 2-1 for Trump. What the hell has happened in the last 12 years?
Hmm. You know, I'm going to comment on that a little bit, too, because I do think that, it's no secret, I worked with Reverend Jesse Jackson. I was deputy campaign manager. I was thrilled with his ability to bridge the rural-urban divide. I saw him
Absolutely.
Out on farms all over the country, you know, when with farm foreclosures and the shifting of jobs from out of the Midwest and to the Sun Belt and all of that. But he had a formula for talking about how to deal with those issues. I think that it's problematic simply to tell people that, okay, there's gonna be some new jobs that are gonna be created by something, but it doesn't deal with their immediate circumstance. What's happening right now? I lost my job. I hear you talking about the Green New Deal or that New Deal and whatever, but I lost my job right now and I don't have a job. So it seems to me the public policy has to take that into account, that if people lose their jobs, that, you know, because plants close and so forth, there's got to be some period in which there is a relief for those workers, for those working class people, no matter what their race and ethnicity is. And I think the failure to do that leaves them vulnerable, you know, to these kinds of appeals. And so I think moving forward, hopefully, you know, what do I know? But I've been thinking a lot about the whole notion that because there are going to be new jobs, that doesn't matter to me. As the brother was, somebody was saying earlier at the kitchen table, theoretically that makes sense. But in the practical terms, I just lost my job and I want to know what it's going to replace. We can get a couple more callers in at 212-209-2877. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Good.
You know, I was in Kingston, Jamaica on election night. I voted before I left New York City. And on election night, there's a curfew in Jamaica, and there's usually difficulty getting people off the street. Well, I got to tell you this. The kind of global anxiety that was hovering over this election result was palpable in every corner of this world. Because not only the people in America, there are people across the globe that said to themselves, let's watch this one closely and see if the American people is going to let us down one more time. What it means for me is chaos. It's coming from the brink of dictatorship. It's coming from the brink of suppression of media. It's coming from the brink of hating immigrants and treating people who worship different people differently because they don't look like you and they don't worship like you. So for I personally, in an African-American, born in Jamaica, lived in this country most of my life, what I saw over the last 4 years, there's no way, no words in the English lexicon to describe it. And as one lady said, when they asked her how long she stood on that line to vote, she said she waited 4.5 years to vote.
Oh,
I'm one of those persons as well.
Yes,
and I could not wait for the count to be over so that America can reinstate its position, its global position in the world, and people can look at us again for the powerful, friendly, and kind society that we have known to be. And I rest my case there.
All right. Okay. Well, I think some people would may argue with some aspects of that, but I think the whole notion of the utter ugliness, the total extremity of this thing is something that people did celebrate. And these celebrations, I think, and I just broke out all over the country. Well, folks, I've really enjoyed the conversation. We obviously are going to have more as we go down the line. I just want to, again, reinforce the idea. Please, folks, become a WBAI buddy. Help the management to be more, have a more predictable sense of what the income is going to look like. I know there's great efforts being made, not only to sustain the session, but build it out. Progress is being made, but we really need your support. And one of the ways to do that is by becoming a WBAI buddy. Once again, you can do that by going to give2wbai.org. The two is the numeral, give2wbai.org. A minimum of $10 a month. You can go as high as you want to. Some people can go 25, others can go 50, 100. Whatever you can do, we can appreciate it. Anyway, this is the professor, and we have appreciated this November 9th post-election, hey, celebration is what I'm talking about, session of Vantage Point here, 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with YCRadio.org. We will see you again next week. Time is really wasted.